Programming for the blind and print impaired. The North Carolina Reading Service brings you Indie Week. The podcast is read today by John Federson. Hello, folks. Our issue this week is dated May the 11th of 2022. And for our music back by special demand this week, actually, it says here by federal statute, is our small musical ensemble from the Office of Fluctuation Control and Ceiling Repair, Bureau of Soluble, Insoluble, and Indigestible Fats and Glutinous Derivatives, Washington, D.C. And we begin from Durham, from Tomasi McDonald's Challenge Accepted, about the sheriff's race for Durham sheriff in the fall. One of the more interesting candidacies to emerge during this election cycle is the campaign of retired law enforcement veteran Maria Gocyss, G-O-C-Y-S, I hope that have that right, who expects to challenge incumbent Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead in November's general election. Burkhead recently updated his campaign website to tout endorsements from the city's most influential political action committees, Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, People's Alliance, and the Friends of Durham, along with endorsements from the Progressive Caucus of the NC Democratic Party and the Indy. On his website, the incumbent, who is one of seven black men elected in 2019 to serve as sheriff in the state's largest counties, also the first African-American elected sheriff in Durham, lists first-term accomplishments. They include serving on Governor Cooper's Task Force for Racial Equity in Criminal Justice, rejecting ICE detainers that target marginalized communities, banning no-knock warrants, and implementing 8-can't-wait policies to reduce police violence following George Floyd's murder in 2020. And Burkhead states on the website, "We're making progress. There is still much to do." Gocyss told the Indy this week that Durham needs a different vision of leadership, saying, "Durham needs a sheriff for all of Durham County. Durham needs someone who will partner with the Durham Police Department and the district attorney's office and rebuilds trust in law enforcement." She notes that even after Durham endured a record number of shootings in 2020 and a record number of homicides in 2021 and is currently on pace to surpass both records in 2022, Burkhead said his office is not responsible for violence that takes place inside the city. Gocyss is referring to comments Burkhead made at a virtual event, the Leesville Road Coalition Candidate Forum, that took place March the 22nd. During the forum, Burkhead asserted that he is, quote, not responsible for the violent crime that occurs inside the Durham city. "This is my county," he says. "This is my city. I have citywide jurisdiction, but I do not carry the stats." Gocyss countered, "A city resident is a county resident. A city taxpayer is a county taxpayer. It's an admission that he's not focused on the city's gun violence. The current sheriff, for all his tough talk, is just talk and not leadership." Burkhead is expected to win in next week's Democratic Party primary against challenger Paul Martin. He declined comment this week about the March 22nd forum. Here, Gocyss, pronounced Gocyss, is a Durham native who retired from the FBI in December. Soon after retiring, she says she has contacted local media and political action committees, talked with friends, reached out to community members, and set up a website in a quest to persuade 4% of Durham's registered voters to sign a petition that would allow her to run as an unaffiliated sheriff's candidate in November. Late last week, Gocyss announced that the Durham County Board of Elections validated 9,599 signatures from the county's registered voters in support of that campaign and certified her as a candidate. She handily surpassed the 9,248 signatures needed before the May 17th deadline. She said in a Friday press release, "I'm humbled by the overwhelming support from Durham County voters for our campaign. Durham County deserves a sheriff who can focus and lead on both the urgent need to bring down Durham's gun violence and advance meaningful police reforms." In addition to focusing on the near unprecedented gun violence that's taking place in Durham, Josie has introduced a 6-point reform agenda that includes a total ban on no-knock warrants. Josie has graduated from Southern High School and worked in East Durham's Wellens Village as a teen. After graduating from East Carolina University, she began a 32-year law enforcement career that started with the Greenville Police Department, followed by 24 years with the FBI. While working for the FBI, Josie led counterterrorism investigations around the globe and was the first woman to lead the FBI's Raleigh office. Before retiring, she worked for 5 years with the FBI's Safe Streets Task Force, which focuses on criminal street gangs in Durham. The Indy this month endorsed Burkhead for re-election, but with several caveats owing to misfires during his term. The most recent was last month when the Indy reported that the sheriff's office has a mutual aid agreement with Alamance County that enables deputies from that county to patrol Bull City streets. Alamance County is one of the most conservative counties in the state, and its deputies are led by a sheriff who is known for his anti-immigration trash talk and pro-Confederate monument values. Sheriff's Office spokesman David Bowser this week told Indy that the sheriff will hold a press conference late Wednesday morning with the other strike team sheriffs to discuss that team's accomplishments. There are also questions of transparency following the mysterious death of Jamari Bumpus, the 18-year-old who died in late 2019 during a sheriff deputy's traffic stop. The deputies first said Bumpus died as a result of crashing his car into a power pole, but later said he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The teen's family filed a federal civil rights lawsuit that accuses the two deputies pulled over Bumpus of killing him and conspiring him to cover it up. Burkhead was among those named in the complaint for his role in the alleged conspiracy. Meanwhile, Joseph this week displayed her own brand of transparency and disclosed what's actually fueling the gun killings in Durham. While working as a member of the FBI's Safe Streets Task Force, which included city police officers, sheriff deputies, and the state's Department of Public Safety, Joseph says the group took a retrospective look at Bull City shootings in recent years. Their assessment, quote, "There's a gang feud that started in 2017 between the 8 Trey gangsta Crips in Bragtown and the non-traditional O Block 8 AM gang," Joseph says. "We're seeing shootings involving these two entities that started with the shooting death of Kyle Fisher, whose alias is the letter O." Joseph says Fisher was an influential gang member in an apartment complex near Horton and Guess Roads. Fisher, 30, of Durham, was mortally wounded on August 7, 2017, on Chalk Level Road west of North Duke Street. Police were not immediately available for comment about the 5-year-old shooting. Joseph explains the O Block folks believed that the 8 Trey gangsta Crips were responsible for Mr. Fisher's death, and says that the feud between those two gangs was behind a shooting just outside the county courthouse on April 3, 2019. She says, quote, "What occurred was a number of rival gang members were all going to the courthouse after hearing that a member of O Block 8 AM was on Instagram the night before bragging about all the gang members he had shot and that he was going to court the next morning." She says the gang feud also led to the tragic death of 9-year-old Zion Person, who was killed in 2018 when a burgundy Honda rolled alongside the SUV he was riding in and opened fire at the intersection of Duke and Leon Streets. "The vehicle the victims were in was misidentified," she explains. "3 members of the 8 Trey gangsta Crips from Bragtown thought the vehicle was occupied by O Block AM. 8 AM. She also offered a sobering and insightful perspective of the gang members who have been charged with serious gun crimes, especially when they realize they are going to be held accountable. She explains, that's when you have a really honest conversation with that person. They drop the street persona. I've had gang members say they were heartbroken by what they had done, that destroyed families and destroyed their own life, and how they wished they had just one single intervention early in their life. She says the Durham Sheriff's Office is in the position to help by partnering with the Durham Police Department that's underwater with so many shootings. They could assist by partnering with the police and going after the people committing the violence and helping out in other ways. There are so many shootings, the Durham Police Department is reactive. The Sheriff's Office could help them to be proactive. Meanwhile, Burkhead on his campaign website says his office, quote, increased efforts to rid our communities of drugs and remove guns from our neighborhoods when he developed a regional strike team of highly trained sheriff's deputies cooperating across four counties to carry out high-risk operations to remove violent offenders from our streets. As Indy previously reported, this strike team came to the public's attention on April 9 when an unmarked SUV Jeep belonging to the Alamance Sheriff's Office was the target of gunfire while patrolling a public housing complex in North Durham. Days later, on April 13th, during a sheriff's candidate forum, Burkhead said Durham County had a strike team together with Alamance, Orange, and Guilford counties. He described that team as a regional partnership aimed at picking up gun and drug runners and stopping gang activities in the areas of Interstates 40 and 85, which he called a delivery pipeline for weapons and drugs, saying, Alamance is overrun with drugs and guns, so we're working together with the other counties and federal agencies because we know what's coming up and down 85 and I-40. For Durham's activist community and the city's solid blue brand of inclusive, equity-driven politics, it's problematic that the sheriff's office has a mutual aid agreement with Alamance County and Sheriff Terry Johnson's deputies. Burkhead did not develop the strike team. Johnson did, at the behest of Matthew Martin, the former Trump-appointed U.S. attorney for the Middle District. The Durham Sheriff's Office signed a memorandum of understanding with Alamance in March of last year. Before signing that memorandum of understanding, Johnson stood before the Alamance County Commissioners and told them he started the strike team in Alamance County to go after gangs in Durham and Guilford counties. He did not mention guns and drugs on the interstate freeways. He said about Durham and Guilford, I tell you, a lot of our problems are coming out of these places. It's not our citizens. Our court systems are failing us in other counties. While Johnston tells Alamance County Commissioners how he really feels about Durham's brand of criminal justice, Joseph wonders why Burkhead doesn't assist the law enforcement resources here in the Bull City. Quote, the sheriff's office would be more effective partnering with the Durham Police Department and the District Attorney's Office, she says. I'll take us now at least one time to the online Indy Week, which publishes some articles that are not into the print edition. This one is about a resolution in the Carrboro Town Council to condemn big money spending in the congressional race. And it's written by Lena Geller. To open the Carrboro Town Council meeting, Tuesday night, poet laureate Fred Joyner read a poem called Currency. It's unclear whether Joyner selected the work as an intentional setting of the stage for one of the meeting's most prominent agenda items. That's a vote on council member Sammy Slade's resolution against super PACs and for democracy, presented specifically in the context of big money contributions dominating the 4th District congressional election. But regardless, it was a cinematic start to an exceptionally tense meeting. The poem's closing lines felt the most pertinent. A debt to erase, a race, a weight, which at least to me spoke to the questions being raised about the $2.5 million in contributions from AIPAC, AIPAC, and cryptocurrency billionaire that candidate and longtime state lawmaker Valerie Fouché has received over the past several months. If Fouché is elected, what will the super PAC who backed her campaign expect in return? What weight will she carry as she enters the congressional arena? Is there a debt insinuated in these contributions? And if so, how will Fouché erase it? In addressing those contributions, Fouché previously told the Indy that she, quote, can't be bought and sold, and nobody owns me. But the fact stands that the contributions have made the race the most expensive congressional primary in North Carolina history, and to think that there isn't any kind of quid pro quo involved seems fairly naive. During the meeting, Slade, who last week published an op-ed in Indy speaking out against the outsized influence of super PACs in that race to fill David Price's seat, put forth a resolution to condemn the, quote, undemocratic spending that has shaped the primary. The resolution notes that Price had personally criticized the role of super PACs in diluting the power of ordinary voters. Slade did not name Fouché. Quote, this isn't about a specific candidate. This is about the sanctity of our electoral process. But it was clear that the money she's received is what sparked this motion. Orange County High School math teacher Hannah Blackburn spoke in support of the resolution, describing how the involvement of big money in politics is an equity issue. She said the investment that can be made by a super PAC, driven by the interest of those people who have been able to build up wealth, will not represent the diversity of the country. It will not represent, as was stated in the resolution, the one person, one vote, and grassroots principle that this town cares a lot about. Before the council voted on the resolution, Slade addressed the hesitations of his colleagues. Some feared that passing the resolution would inappropriately influence the election, he said, while others found the issue to be divisive to council relationships. Carrboro Mayor Damon Seals and Council Member Barbara Fouché have both endorsed Valerie Fouché in the primary. Slade argued that the council's failure to denounce massive special interest contributions would be a position in itself, asking, isn't our silence a form of influence on this election? Isn't it a tacit agreement that the corrosiveness of this kind and amount of money is okay? This race is being bought now. Now is the time to speak. He augmented his assertion with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., quote, I was not afraid of the words of the violent, but the silence of the honest. In a previous interview with Indy, Fouché also quoted MLK in reference to the contributions. Say, quote, I wonder how many people remember what he said about the most important question, which is, what are you doing? You can criticize me all day, but take some of that time and go help somebody. Implying that her years of public service are more significant than the big money donations that she's received. Slade's resolution failed. It did not receive a second. Seals shared concerns about the resolution's potential to, quote, uplift one candidate and take a swipe at another. It would have the effect of pulling the town council as a governing body of a municipality into an ongoing election contest. That is not a place I think the town or town council ought to be pulled. The morning after the meeting, Slade told Indy that he feels saddened that his colleagues are unable to see this moment for what it is. Quote, this is something that we would very easily have passed at any other time, but because it's touching down now, folks are unable to recognize democracies being undermined. In response to Seals' argument that the resolution would inappropriately influence the election, Slade said, a more inappropriate influence is the amount of money that has gone into the race, and reiterated that the council's silence contradicts the values it professes to stand for. Often, he said, we think of the vocal part as being damaging, but the silence is just as damaging. Nita Alam and Clay Aiken, who stand along Fouché as front runners in the Democratic primary, have each criticized, indirectly and directly, the big money contributions that Fouché has received during her campaign. In a recent ad, Alam stated that, quote, super PACs are spending millions trying to silence me. At a press conference this morning, as reported by the News and Observer, Aiken said the contributions have led him to, quote, lose respect for Fouché, a candidate who he previously held in high regard. North Carolina Representative Marsha Morey, whose district is located in Durham, also rescinded her endorsement of Fouché this week and endorsed Alam, citing Fouché's refusal to disavow massive out-of-state donations from AIPAC and the crypto billionaire. Now, the statewide primary takes place on Tuesday, next Tuesday, May 11th. Early voting is already underway. Now we have some art and cultural-related articles. However, the bulk of the informational and, significant articles in Indie Week this week are all concerned with Roe versus Wade, abortion in North Carolina, and related substance-related articles. Jasmine Gallup writes this article called Uncertain Future. A short woman wearing oversized sunglasses, her dirty blonde hair piled up in a half bun, stands on the sidewalk in downtown Raleigh. Her colorful sign, written in pink and yellow marker, adorned with flowers, has a blunt but straightforward message. My BFF and I do not regret our abortions. Lauren Youngman, 41, had her abortion 8 years ago after she started experiencing complications in a planned pregnancy with her husband. Youngman had already named her baby boy, Kai, when the doctors told her something was wrong. 5 months into pregnancy, more than halfway to the finish line, she had a choice: abort her baby now or watch him likely die in her arms. She told Indy, "It was hard, but I have never regretted it. My husband and I were just really thankful for that choice." For now, abortion is still legal in North Carolina. But access to that choice is on the line as the U.S. Supreme Court considers its decision in a landmark case to be released later this year. A rare glimpse into the future of abortion rights came last week when a draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court on a case known as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization leaked to Politico. That draft, penned by staunchly conservative Justice Samuel Alito and supported by the court's other four Republican appointees, completely overturns the national constitutional right to abortion, wiping out the 50-year precedent set by Roe v. Wade. In short, it's the worst-case scenario. It would leave the choices of women in the hands of state legislators who, in North Carolina for years, have been trying to restrict and ban abortions. Molly Rivera, a spokeswoman for Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, says, "North Carolina won't be the first to ban abortion, but we could very well be second or third. It depends on what the state legislature decides to do and the results of this year's election." Unlike other southern states, North Carolina doesn't have a trigger law that would immediately ban abortion if federal protection ends. But the state has long been hostile towards abortion and reproductive rights. Tara Romano, executive director of the Pro-Choice North Carolina, a grassroots advocacy organization, says there have been extreme abortion bans introduced. They never got anywhere. They didn't get into committee. But there have been personhood bans, 6 weeks bans. So we're expecting anti-abortion lawmakers will want to figure out how they can introduce something that will pass. Whether they do it or not in the short legislative session this year, we don't know. In the past few years, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has staved off attempts at restricting abortion, vetoing bills approved by the majority Republican state legislatures. Whether Cooper can continue to effectively use his veto to protect rights will depend on the results of the fall's midterm elections. If Republicans win a supermajority, they need just two more seats in the state Senate and three in the House. They can override Cooper's veto. It's also possible that a state law banning abortion after 20 weeks could be revived. The law, which was previously ruled unconstitutional, would have to be revisited by the courts. Romano says that's one of the things we think potentially could quickly come back into place, certainly if the Supreme Court hands down a ruling that is similar or exactly like the draft that was leaked. State lawmakers could easily go back and say, well, the court said this 20-week ban was unconstitutional, But based on this new ruling, it's clear we should revisit that. Romano says so far, abortion advocates have been able to hold the line against restrictions. But everything depends on the upcoming elections. Not only are state legislative seats up for grabs, but there are also judicial races on the ballot, which will decide who sits on district courts and the state's Supreme Court. Those judges could eventually weigh in on cases of doctors and patients being prosecuted for abortions. If laws like this had been in effect 25 years ago, Ashley Reynolds, then 17, would never have been able to get her abortion. Reynolds, Youngman's BFF, had her abortion in St. Louis, in a clinic that no longer exists, in a state where abortion has now been banned, she says. Quote, I feel fortunate. My parents supported me, my mom went with me, and I don't regret it. I never have. It's weird being 40-something, and we had more rights in our teens than we do now. I feel so bad for these young generations. Reynolds and Youngman were just two among hundreds of women and men who gathered in downtown Raleigh last week to protest the potential overturning of Roe v. Wade. The mood in the crowd was fearful, but also angry and determined. Cars and trucks honked to show support as they drove through the intersection of Wilmington and Harget Streets. They were met by thundering cheers from protesters. I'm not necessarily scared for myself, but I'm scared for my girls, said Lacey Thomas, a protester, accompanied by her 9-year-old daughter, Brinley, both carrying pink, glittery signs, and angry. It's the same sort of enraged feeling I've sort of been feeling since 2016. It just comes and goes in waves. As the crowd marched up to the state capitol, chants filled the air. No forced pregnancy, protesters shouted. Abortion is health care. My body, my choice. One woman standing in front of a TV camera said, my body is not for political battles. People who get abortions are often shamed, harassed, or threatened by anti-choice zealots for their decision, but abortion is a safe and common medical procedure. Romano says, one of the things we try to help people understand is that abortion is on the spectrum of reproductive health care, along with preventing an unplanned pregnancy, sexual health care, and carrying a pregnancy safely to term. It's been pulled out and isolated as part of a political movement. Because it's so politicized, it becomes very theoretical for a lot of people, but it's not. These restrictions aren't just there in theory. They really are harming people who are trying to access care they've decided they need. In 2019, about 16% of pregnancies in North Carolina were terminated through abortion, according to the NC State Center for Health Statistics. The majority of those abortions were by people 20 to 34 years old. More than half were by people who already had at least one child. That was the case for Elisa Ellis, who already had a 9-year-old son when she elected to have a second abortion at age 30. She's also a volunteer board member for Carolina Abortion Fund, a nonprofit that gives financial, practical, and emotional support to people trying to access abortion care. She says, I was very clear I wanted to terminate the pregnancy as soon as possible, but accessing abortion was challenging even with health insurance. The original quote was $1,500, and then I was crying on the phone, and they said they could do it for $1,000. But I had to finance that through a payment plan because it was a huge out-of-pocket expense. Ellis says the high price tag of abortions is one of the biggest barriers to care. Not only do people have to pay often for abortion out-of-pocket because North Carolina has prohibited public and some private insurers from including abortion coverage in their health plans, but people are often also forced to take unpaid time off for work, pay for child care, and travel long distances to get an abortion, paying for airfare, gas, and lodging. Ellis's abortion was a little more expensive because she got it at a hospital instead of a clinic. The average cost in North Carolina is $300 to $600, but prices can reach into the thousands, depending on when the abortion is performed. North Carolina's restrictive laws make accessing care even more difficult. In a state of 10.5 million people, there are 14 clinics, all clustered in urban areas. People who want an abortion are required to wait 3 days and undergo mandatory biased counseling. Doctors are banned from prescribing pills for medical abortions via telehealth appointments. People under the age of 18 also have to get permission from a parent or guardian to seek an abortion, a law that would have prevented Ellis's first abortion had her mother not been supportive. "I had my first abortion at 17 because I wanted to go to college," Ellis says. "My high school sweetheart at the time was like, 'We can just not go to college. My parents can help us get a trailer and live together.' I was like, 'No, I want to go to college. I was getting ready to go to Meredith. It was my senior year of high school.'" Today, in addition to advocating for access to abortion, Ellis is a senior director at American Oversight, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that works to uncover public records and promote transparency and accountability in government. At the moment, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it looks like North Carolina may be one of the southernmost states where people can access abortion, at least for a time. If that happens, abortion clinics in North Carolina could be flooded with people from South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia. Our state could see up to a 4,600% increase in women seeking abortions, according to the Guttmacher Institute. With such high demand, resources would be scarce. Waiting times for appointment would likely skyrocket, and money for abortion assistance could be short. The Carolina Abortion Fund already has had to shut down its call line after 2 or 3 weeks each month, simply because it runs out of funding, says Ellis. Fortunately, after the Roe v. Wade news broke this week, the fund received an outpouring of support, raising close to $100,000 in donations. Ellis says, "This funding will make abortion care a reality and practical support a reality for so many more people. A lot of times we're not funding the full cost of abortion, we're subsidizing it. This influx is incredibly, incredibly meaningful." Although abortion rights activists nationwide are preparing themselves for the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the draft opinion released last week is far from final, according to Neil Siegel, a professor of law and political science at Duke University and former clerk of Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When the Supreme Court releases its definitive decision later this year, it's possible the opinions of some on the court will have changed, Siegel said in a news release. Quote, "When I clerked at the court, the draft main dissent in the case eventually became the final majority opinion. I'm not suggesting anything like that will happen now, but it's not over until the opinions are handed down." Siegel added that if the opinion shifts from majority to plurality, it could be rewritten to take a softer stance on Roe v. Wade, lessening the impact on abortion rights and future cases. He said, "At other times, a tentative bare majority can lose a fifth vote and become a plurality opinion. This would mean not a different outcome in Dobbs, but different reasoning that could have less severe implications for future cases." What effects the Supreme Court's decision will have remains to be seen. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, the decision will also have implications for the right to privacy, a right on which birth control access, same-sex marriage, and health care for transgender people also rest. In the meantime, women statewide are holding their breath, hoping that somehow, some way, the Republican-appointed justices of the U.S. Supreme Court will change their minds. One of those women is 20-year-old Izzy Jackson, a rising senior at NC State, who joined last week's Raleigh protest. Jackson has never needed an abortion, but if Roe v. Wade is overturned, her needs won't matter. She said with a strained laugh, "I just hope they don't overturn it. I'm just praying and hoping." Since abortion is still legal in all over North Carolina, not counting the restrictions in locations, the Indie Week, pardon me, the Indie Week has included a chart of where you can get an abortion, and I'm going to read that statewide. We have quite a few people who listen to this broadcast around the state, where you can get an abortion in North Carolina. And we start in the west and move east. Asheville, Planned Parenthood, the Asheville Health Center, phone 828-252-7298. Chapel Hill, Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic, Chapel Hill Health Center, 919-942-7762. In Charlotte, a Preferred Women's Health Center, 888-562-7415. Also in Charlotte, a Woman's Choice of Charlotte, 704-367-2255. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, the Charlotte Health Center, 704-536-7233. In Durham, North Durham Women's Health, two phone numbers, 919-908-6449 or 855-443-4892. In Fayetteville, the Hallmark Women's Clinic, 910-323-3792 or an 800 appointment line, 24 hours, 800-682-8677. Also in Fayetteville, Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, 866-942-7762. And in Greensboro, a Woman's Choice of Greensboro, 336-273-9485. In Raleigh, two numbers, a Preferred Woman's Health Center, 919-854-7888, or Woman's Choice of Raleigh, 919-781-6811. In Winston-Salem, Hallmark Women's Clinic, 336-725-4924, or a 24-hour appointment line, 888-775-8524. The other address in Winston-Salem, or phone number, is Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic, 336-768-2980. And finally, in Wilmington, Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic, 910-762-5566. And another sidebar, where to donate and or volunteer. These are websites. So, and again, if you've missed some of this and can't re-listen to the podcast, you can find IndieWeek.com and look for these articles and numbers. The Triangle Abortion Access Coalition, they are at linktr.ee/triangle access. linktr.ee/triangle access. Sister Song, that's at website sistersong.net. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, that's plannedparenthood.org. And .planned-parenthood-south-atlantic. So that's one website, plannedparenthood.org. Planned-parenthood-south-atlantic. Pro-Choice North Carolina is at prochoicenc.org. Keep Our Clinics is at keepourclinics.org. And Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline is at mahotline.org. And finally, where to request financial assistance for abortion services, the Carolina Abortion Fund website, carolinaabortionfund.org. Planned Parenthood South Atlantic is plannedparenthood.org.planned Planned Parenthood-South-Atlantic, and the National Abortion Federation Hotline, which is a phone number, 800-772-9100. There is a referral line, I'm not sure what that means, 877-257-0012. All right, there are lots of arts and cultural stories to fill up our time. We won't have time for nearly all of them. But the first one is called A Series of Fortunate Events. These are events throughout the Triangle. The sixth annual A Series of Fortunate Events explores the many definitions of movement. Allison Kirkland writes this. You probably didn't read about Camp Gen Ed in your high school history textbooks, a summer camp for disabled teens in operation from 1951 to 1977. The New York Catskills Camp paved the way for activists who are still living and working today. Each magical summer, a group of campers, some of whom had come from government-run institutions, experienced a kind of autonomy and community they didn't have access to in their daily lives. It changed them. James Lebrecht, former camper and the co-writer and co-director of the 2020 Oscar-nominated documentary Crip Camp, says in the film, "What we saw at that camp is that our lives could be better. You don't know what to strive for if you don't know it exists." Ignited by their ability to create change, many campers, as well as counselors, led by disability rights pioneer and Crip Camp star Judy Heumann, H-E-U-M-A-N-N, became activists and launched a disability civil rights movement that continues to this day. Movement is the inspiration behind the upcoming sixth annual Series of Fortunate Events Festival, organized by Arts Access, a Raleigh-based nonprofit that bridges disability and the arts by providing advocacy, training, outreach, and accessibility. As the organization defines it, movement can refer either to the act of changing physical location or to a group of people working together to advance their ideas. The festival provides ample opportunities to explore both definitions of that word. Eileen Bagnall, executive director of Arts Access, says 25% of the population has a disability. We hope the festival gives the community a chance to see incredible art making from members of the disability community and how their work isn't any different than any other working artists. The summer-long festival kicks off this week, May 14th, at the North Carolina Museum of Art with two showings of the bold and rollicking Crip Camp, which is as relevant and boundary-pushing today as it was when it debuted in 2020. Each of these showings will be preceded by a never-before-seen virtual panel with Heumann and Virginia Knowlton Marcus, CEO of Disability Rights NC. The pair are longtime friends as well as colleagues and will discuss how Heumann navigated a nascent movement. The relevance of the film's themes extend well beyond the camp itself. Heumann says, "Crip Camp is an example of collaboration where disabled people were significant drivers of the discussion and the format. But the messages within the film have impacted disabled people and non-disabled people alike, in different ways." Heumann expresses her hope that the film will pave the way for other narratives about disability. She says, "I want Crip Camp to be one of many. It's obviously a fantastic film and one that should be utilized forever, really, because it tells a very powerful story. But it is not the totality of the disability stories." When I asked her to name a few of her favorite disabled artists, she pointed to the works of composer Galen Lee, L-E-A, producer and animator Caitlin Yang, and writer Alice Wong, among others. Series events will continue throughout the summer. On June 4, In partnership with the Durham County Main Library, Arts Access will host visual art and movement activities inspired by the 2021 children's picture book, We Move Together, recommended for ages 6 through 9. Written by two disabled educators and illustrated by a multimedia artist, this joyful and inclusive book celebrates the inherently creative and innovative ways that disabled bodies move through the world and create community. This event will also feature two short performances by Calm Motion, a local dance company that provides low-cost dance and movement classes to people of all abilities. Each participant will receive a free copy of We Move Together. The festival culminates with a juried art exhibition, Movement. That will be on display July 1 through August 30 at the Hall Gallery in Raleigh's Sertoma Arts Center, with a reception held on Sunday, July 24th. Kim Tyler, an acrylic landscape painter and ink artist who also happens to be legally blind, will serve as a juror. North Carolina-based disabled artists who want to submit their work may apply through the Arts Access website through May 16th. That's coming up right now, the deadline for applications. As with all of its offerings, Arts Access has taken great care to make the entire festival accessible, providing live ASL interpretation and audio descriptions for both Crip Camp showings, as well as ways to participate in all three festival events from home. And in the spirit of accessibility, the entire festival is free to the public. She says, when we think about accessibility in the literal sense, we think ramps, handlebars, curb cuts, sign language interpreters, captioning, audio description. All those things allow access. But we also need to be looking at the barriers that are currently in place that restrict people from feeling welcome and valued in whatever it is that they're doing. The conversation about disability is getting more mainstream, but we still have a long way to go toward recognizing all the essential contributions of this diverse community. The Series of Fortunate Events Festival offers one easy but impactful opportunity to celebrate local disabled artists. And I'll just reiterate that, application for disabled artists. This is actually May the 12th right now, today when I'm reading this. And the May 16th, in 4 days at the end of the week, I guess you would look for the Arts Access website if you have something that might possibly still be entertained for a display at this festival. And I have time to read a book review or interview, let's put it that way, at least in part, in my last 9 minutes, called Outside the Lines. Sarah Edwards writes this, reviewing and talking to Erin Lane about her book, Something Other Than a Mother. Several months ago, Maggie Gyllenhaal released her adaptation of Eleanor Ferrante's novel, The Lost Daughter. That film follows Lida, played by Olivia Colman, a translator on a solo vacation who becomes fixated on a young mother, her daughter, and the daughter's doll, which Lida steals for reasons she doesn't even fully seem to understand. The story then touches on Lida's own experience, parenting, and being, as she describes, an unnatural mother. The film is a radical, elliptical portrayal of a woman at odds with motherhood. It's also uncomfortable, particularly because Lida's prickly loner persona, and partially because ambivalence about parenthood is not a story often told, even though it's often felt. Now, the book Someone Other Than a Mother is a new book blending research and memoir by Raleigh author Erin Lane. It's one welcome contribution to that particular canon, weaving in stories about people who fall outside of the dominant family narrative, people who don't have children, people who can't have children, people who come into parenthood unexpectedly. Lane, who is now an adoptive parent of three daughters, issues an invitation to broaden our ideas, not just about womanhood, but about personhood. She's a graduate of Duke's Divinity School and writes from a Christian perspective, but the book's reach feels farther than that. This interview, which has been edited for clarity and length, was originally timed to Mother's Day, but was postponed. Coincidentally, its timing now with the leaked Supreme Court Roe v. Wade document feels more relevant than ever with the book's blunt considerations of choice, purpose, parenthood, and what it means to make decisions outside of the patriarchy. The remainder of this article is kind of question and answer. You talk about wanting to rewrite the kind of social script around motherhood. What do you see that script looking like now? Lane replies, in the book I talked about the mother scripts and this idea that women have gotten the message that their reproductive role is supposed to be the ultimate expression of a life well lived. What I tried to do in the book is set out all of these pervasive cultural sayings that push women or society into believing that mother love is a superior love. So even if it's not women's only purpose, it still feels like we are getting the message that if you mother, it should be the thing that colors everything else in your life. And if you don't mother, you're not living in technicolor. I think that's the central mother script, the mother of all mother scripts, that you don't know love until you become a mother. Can you talk about the book's structure? There are 9 cultural scripts that felt the most pervasive in my life and in my social location, and every chapter lays out that script from your biological clock is ticking to but you'd make a great mom to you'll regret not having kids. That often women who aren't parroting hear the loudest. I also wanted to explore them as someone that used to be child-free and then found herself unexpectedly parenting. How are these messages about the before and after of a woman's life really detrimental to mothers and really rude about the kinds of people and the kinds of meaning and fulfillment and calling we led before we became someone's parent? And so every chapter is a pervasive cultural saying that I'm a little suspect of. And then every chapter is my suggestion for an alternative rewrite. There's an awkwardness people seem to feel around women who have chosen not to have children. She answers, yeah, I was the recipient of a lot of that awkwardness, which I describe as blank stares, long pauses. People seem to have a feeling that once they had nothing in common with me, once they learned that that was not the trajectory that my life was on. A lot of people also wanted to convince me that I wasn't seeing the full picture, that it was a lack of confidence rather than conviction that made me count myself out of biological mothering. Religion is a clear through line in the book, though I imagine not everyone drawn to it will be coming from a faith background. What do you see as your audience? I'm a theologian by training, or a theological anthropologist, and my background is in anthropology, theology, and gender studies. So, this is always the lens that I bring. I wanted to parse both how I had received certain messages from American Christianity about what a life well lived looked like, and also because American Christianity is a very dominant and loud and pervasive in a lot of cultural conversations, I wanted to explore how, even if you are not Christian or coming from a different faith background, these messages about the purpose or primacy of family or what a legacy looks like are still the waters many of us swim in. And the final question. This book also seems to be a bit about relationships and about how culture doesn't put as much emphasis on adult friendships as it does familial relationships. Erin Lane responds, as I get older, I realize the complexity of my own family system and have friends that are doing that same work with adult parents and siblings and sometimes children. And why don't we talk about family like friends, right? Friendship is often the love that people express as giving them the most joy and the most wellness. There have been a lot of studies about older people in friendships and how that really is one of the defining factors of healthy old age. Like, why don't we lift up friends' love as the ultimate expression of love rather than mother or family? It seems like that would be a lot more generous and democratic because you don't have to have certain body parts to practice it. You don't have to have a certain family system, but it is really a love of intention, you know, rather than inevitability. And I think that it's gotten lost in culture writ large because we don't have a lot of rituals around it. We don't have, like, sacraments of friendship or legal ways of recognizing friendship that we do for biological families. I think we're missing out on a really big, expansive love. And that was Erin Lane's words, the Raleigh author of Someone Other Than a Mother, written by Sarah Edwards, that column. And for a minute or two, cultural events coming up, and I can only just scroll down a list of all kinds of events, mostly film, well, other author books, etc., movies, and I'll just read them and the locations that are very briefly given, but you can find a longer calendar and the full calendar at indieweek.com. Very, very useful, all around the triangle and beyond. Life Before Dinosaurs at the Museum of Natural Sciences, and that goes from 10 to 5. That's every day. Let's see. Prom Night Film Series is the Cary Theater at 5 p.m. This is all today. Darius Quarles, Five Point Gallery Featured Artist, Five Point Gallery at 5 p.m. That is tomorrow. These are all Friday events. Soylent Green is presented at the Museum of Natural Sciences at 5:30. Kids Zoo Children's Museum has Parents Night Out at 6. David Wright Falladay, Black Cloud Rising, is an author at McIntyre's Books at 6:30, Friday again. Elements Arts has 7 p.m. Musical Chairs, a free outdoor concert series. Check your weather. And Grow and Bloom Gala is at 7 p.m. And the Patrick McGrew Trio appears at the Oak House at Friday, 7:30 p.m. Emma is presented at Peace University at 7:30 on Friday. And there's the Shana Tucker Quartet at Sharp 9 Gallery, Friday, 8 p.m. The Power Plant Gallery has Attractions and Distractions appearing at 8 p.m. There's Josh Rosenstein's Luxury Comedy Hoot Nanny at Imbibe at 8 p.m. And at Bright Penny Brewing Comedy Showcases at 8. J.P. Sears appears at Goodnights and the Factory Restaurant at 10 p.m. on Friday. And scroll ahead to Saturday. No, I won't. Goodbye.